It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. For decades, American healthcare workers have been using specialized medical isotopes to diagnose heart disease and cancers. But those isotopes, they traditionally need to be made with nuclear reactors, and none of those reactors are in the U.S. But that could soon change with a new $263 million loan from the Department of Energy. A Janesville-based company plans to build an isotope factory in its hometown using fusion technology this time instead of traditional nuclear power. How could a Wisconsin-based isotope supply chain impact medicine? For that, we turn to David Dick, a clinical professor of radiology at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine. He spoke with host Rob Ferret.
All right, we've got these nuclear isotopes, the molybdenum-99 and the things that it breaks down into. They're used in medical imaging. Can you give us a sense of what they're used for and how critical they are to our healthcare?
Yes. So molybdenum-99, which I'll call Molly-99 from here on out just because it's a lot easier to say, is the parent radionuclide for technetium-99m, which is the most commonly used radionuclide in nuclear medicine. Approximately 80% of all nuclear medicine procedures use technetium-99m. It's used in a variety of different radioactive drugs to image all sorts of physiological events that occur within the body. It's relatively short-lived, so the technetium-99m has a half-life of 6 hours, which means that half of it is decaying every 6 hours. And so we use generators where the parent radionuclide, Molly-99, decays into the technetium-99m, and that allows nuclear pharmacists to prepare those radioactive drugs on-site in the hospital for these imaging studies.
Wow. So critical stuff, as I understand it, we don't make it in the United States. We're working toward that now. It's the clock is ticking as we're using it. Have we run into international supply chain problems where we get worried, hey, we may not have this critical material in the hospital when we need it?
Yes. So the Molly-99 has a half-life of 66 hours. So you can't just store up a whole bunch of Molly-99 and hold on to it for a rainy day. These hospitals need these generators delivered on a weekly basis. Traditionally, all of the production of Molly-99 happens outside of the United States, primarily in Europe, South Africa, and Australia. The issue we face is that a lot of these facilities were built in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and so they're old. They are subject to breakdowns and unexpected shutdowns that leads to a crisis with us not being able to obtain the Molly-99 that we need for these nuclear medicine studies.
Another wrinkle here, as I understand it, the traditional way of producing this Molly-99 involved enriched uranium. And there's some hesitation in wanting to go to lots of new places and try to find production centers and have more enriched uranium, potentially enrichable for weapons-grade material out in the world. That's another problem here in getting this stuff produced in the United States and abroad?
So that was a problem years ago. And all of these sites have converted from using highly enriched uranium to low enriched uranium. So we don't have that problem of nuclear material out there that could be used for weapons. However, the issue we're running into is that the low enriched uranium doesn't produce as much of the Molly-99 as the highly enriched uranium. So it's decreased the capacity worldwide.
Why haven't we seen domestic suppliers pick this up, do you think?
So the issue is a historical one where there were many other producers that were subsidizing, the countries were subsidizing the production of the Molly-99. And so it didn't make economic sense for the United States to build a facility and enter the market. But as we've run into some of these supply chain issues with these older manufacturing facilities and having to ship it in, from overseas, it's really highlighted a a critical link in the supply chain and the need to have a domestic supply to avoid some of these issues in the future.
Now, here we have the federal government helping incentivize this and something in the works here in Wisconsin in Janesville. As you look at this plan, are you hopeful that this is going to help us be less reliant on that unstable supply chain?
Yes, I think the facility that Shine is building provides a new technology that's not as reliant on nuclear reactors as the current technology. It provides a domestic supply, and it's innovative. Using nuclear fusion rather than nuclear fission like you use in the reactors gives you a different production route that has the potential to scale up much more quickly than building more nuclear reactors.
And then on that ticking clock of the half-life of the materials involved, if we're shipping from Midwestern United States around the country versus across an ocean, is that just going to be more efficient? Will we be able to make better use of this material because less will decay in transit?
Certainly that will help some. It's not going to be as big an effect in that, you know, you're talking about things that have a multiple day half-life. So, you know, a few hours versus a day doesn't have a large effect, but certainly by having it more localized, it minimizes the chance of problems, you know, due to weather or customs or some of the other issues that you can run into when you're shipping things over long distances.
I understand you've worked with the Society of Nuclear Medicine and Nuclear Imaging's FDA task force. What other solutions are you hoping to see out there when it comes to the availability of these key isotopes for our medical imaging?
I think the big thing is to have a diversification of supply. When you rely on just a single supplier, you're at the whims of whether that supplier can meet demand. And if that supplier has a problem, then you have to shut down production. By having multiple routes, be it you know, multiple international or having a combination of international and domestic, you're ensuring that you're going to have constant supply for these radionuclides and be able to provide these drugs to the patients.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was David Dick, clinical professor of radiology at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine. We're talking about nuclear medicine and using nuclear technology to create potentially life-saving healthcare equipment. Through a $263 million federal loan, a Wisconsin-based company is planning to build a new production facility for medical isotopes in Janesville using fusion energy. Now, the Janesville company Shine Technologies is at the heart of that project, building a Mo-99 production facility with fusion technology right here in the state. Greg Pfeiffer is Shine's CEO. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks. A pleasure to be here.
All right, we've been hearing about this cutting-edge technology for diagnostic procedures, important ones. If somebody said, hey, Rob, this is going on in the United States, guess where? I'll be honest, I wouldn't have guessed Wisconsin. Why is this research happening here in the state?
Yeah, so fundamentally, the technology that we've developed, which is nuclear fusion technology that we plan to eventually turn towards making abundant clean energy, the core technology actually came out of the graduate school work I did at the University of Wisconsin, and then the state was very aggressive in keeping us here as we looked at where to build the company.
Tell us a little bit about the road from that research at UW to, hey, we have this company, it's doing fusion stuff that we're actually using.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty interesting road. as a guy with a PhD nuclear engineering degree, which is what I finished school with, you know, you think you've got a cool technology and you think developing the technology is what it takes to build a company, but it's actually it's a small piece of what it takes to build a company. You have that, and it's disruptive and really incredible. And we actually proved the technology would do what we thought it would pretty early on. But then you need to deploy that in a commercial environment, and you need to build a real customer base, and you need to make those customers happy. And there's all kinds of infrastructure that you have to build to make a company really work and really work very, very well. So it's been a road. I think I speak the language of business probably now just as well as I speak the language of technology. And I like learning, and so it's been actually mostly a fun road, but certainly quite a walk.
Now, fission smashes atoms apart, fusion smooshes them together. Can you paint us a picture of what one of your fusion facilities works like to make this? If we were there looking at it, what would we see?
Yeah, so we have these fusion systems that exist, and they're in use today. And essentially, it's a long, tall vertical system, so maybe 15 feet in total. And at the top of the system, we make a beam of what's called deuterium. And deuterium is just a form of hydrogen. So it's prevalent in the Earth's oceans and things like that. And we shoot it down into a target, which consists of tritium. And so deuterium and tritium is the easiest fusion reaction to make happen. It happens at the lowest temperature. It happens with the highest probability. And it makes neutrons, which is what we want. So, by the way, the only byproduct of this process, so neutrons are the product we want. The byproduct of this is helium. It's the stuff you fill balloons with.
Which there's also a shortage of. Do you get to use that helium?
We don't produce enough of it, actually, for it to be interesting versus, you know, the stuff we pull out of the ground. But and that's one of the really cool things about nuclear energy in general is it doesn't take much to make a lot. So we actually don't produce enough helium, but it's very benign compared to what comes out of a fission reactor. So if you look at what comes out of a fission reactor when you're making neutrons, you get all kinds of nuclear waste. You get some that's short-lived, a lot that's long-lived, some that's transuranic that we just don't know how to dispose of. So the core fusion process as a driving mechanism produces the neutrons you want and helium. So it's a much cleaner process. And frankly, at the end of the day, it ends up being much safer because of that. And then those neutrons strike a target and they turn it into the radioisotope we want, which we end up using to diagnose or treat disease.
And that brings us back to this molybdenum-99. Hate saying that word again and again.
Very close. It's good job.
Molybdenum. I've been working on it. You've got this loan announcement from the Department of Energy's Office of Energy Dominance Financing. There have been some questions about research-related funding from the current administration. How locked down is this? Are you able to plan based on it?
Yeah, I mean, we feel pretty good about it. A conditional commitment's been issued. So as long as we meet the conditions of the commitment, we will be able to draw that facility. So we're certainly moving towards achieving those and feel highly confident we're going to achieve them in the very near future. So that instrument seems available, and it will give us more than enough funding to actually complete Chrysalis and fully scale its capability, making it the largest isotope production facility in the world.
And when in your timeline would you see actually producing Mo-99 that's going to hospitals?
Yeah, it's probably a couple years from now in terms of at large scale. You know, I think test batches could be as little as 18 months, but when we're talking about actually starting to displace reactor-based product in a meaningful scale, it's probably a couple of years.
And then you mentioned, you know, the long-term roadmap is fusion energy. How actively are you pursuing that? And do you have a timeline on when you'd hope to have that up and running?
Yes, so very actively. And in fact, the entire business model of accessing these higher-paying markets first is based on getting us to fusion energy as fast as possible. So just a brief explanation of how we got here. I got a PhD to study how to bring nuclear fusion energy to Earth. And we worked really hard to see what it would actually take to commercialize it. And at the end of the day, my takeaway was it's going to take a lot of time and money and practice to get the cost of fusion low enough to be competitive with other energy sources. And I thought, that would be a bit of a long road. And maybe too much for investors to take. And but I had this other experience where I started another company with some roommates of mine when I was in graduate school. And it was totally unrelated. We were recovering data from crashed hard drives because we thought that the business model that existed out there was unfair. Essentially, the companies out there were like, pay us $2,000 and maybe we'll get your stuff back. And when you're a college student, that doesn't seem right. So we started a business that had a simpler model, which was if we get your stuff, you'll pay us. And we weren't very good at it. We told people that, but people really liked the business model so much that we got all kinds of traffic. And within, you know, several years, we were doing we were one of the best data recovery labs on the planet, and even we're doing work for folks like the FBI. So it taught me how quickly product progress in practice can improve a product and can improve your skills. And so I really wondered coming out of that if I could apply a similar approach to Fusion, where we could commercialize it in near-term markets, use that to practice in a real commercial environment, and use the reinvestment that comes from learnings and earnings and everything else, all the meritous things that come from practicing in a real business, and scale Fusion that way. And I decided that I thought I would create a company to do that because I thought it was a really good approach. And by the way, it's how other deep tech businesses have scaled. So if you look at things like semiconductors, especially, or EVs or space, or even solar, all scaled this way. They started with the highest paying customers at low volume, used it to get their unit costs down, and then they expanded into larger markets. And so when we started developing Fusion, we really looked at the different things Fusion could do. And for a product to be interesting to us, it had to do three things. One, it had to move us toward fusion energy. So we had to believe practicing in this market built the skills we needed to perfect fusion energy. Number two, the problem had to be important. And important just meant that a lot of people needed it. A way of measuring that is total addressable market for the product. And the product had to scale as we did. And then finally, fusion had to give us a right to win versus incumbent technologies. So we filtered that way. We came up with a list of essentially four major product categories. We call them now test, medical, recycling, and energy. And then we just force ranked those by best unit economics. So we went and we said, which one of these will pay us the most per unit? And we're going to start there because that's the most forgiving environment to practice in. And as we practice there, we'll get the cost down and we'll be able to scale into these larger markets as we go. So it's not just that we can use Fusion for different things. It's that practicing Fusion in these markets is probably the fastest way to actually commercialize it for energy. And so, for example, just since the first systems we've built for test, we've reduced the cost of Fusion output. If we were to measure Fusion output in kilowatt hours, which is essentially energy, we've reduced the cost per kilowatt hour by over 10,000 times since starting the business, just by practicing and reinvesting the things that we've learned. And so everything we do is to perfect fusion energy, whether it's testing or making radioisotopes or recycling nuclear waste. So we're moving very quickly in this direction. Our current expectation is to have the first sort of fusion-based energy on the grid in the mid-2030s. And this will use what we call hybrid technology, like Chrysalis does, where we have a fusion system driving a highly multiplying fission system. And ultimately expect pure fusion energy to be on the grid in the mid-2040s. But expect fusion energy to start contributing to the grid in sort of the time frame of the mid-2030s. And that's a lot sooner than most people think.
And Greg, I'm sure you've heard the joke. I've heard it since the 80s. When will fusion power be a reality? In 10 years? But the answer is always in 10 years, no matter how far ahead you go. That's changing, it sounds like.
Well, the joke is getting better because when I was in grad school, it was 30 and then it was 20 and now it's 10. So,
all right.
I actually think it is converging, which is very it's encouraging to hear you say 10.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. Nice talking to you.
Greg Pfeiffer is CEO of the Janesville fusion company Shine Technologies. He spoke with Rob Barrett about efforts to bring medical isotope production into Wisconsin with fusion technology. We previously heard from David Dick, clinical professor of radiology at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine.